First of all, may I bring you greetings by reminding you that grace is yours and peace from God our Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. St. Paul always used those words of greetings to all the churches. So do I. I don't think that he used them perfunctorily, nor is that my intention, for by grace he meant all the initiating power of God for good in our lives and through us in society. I know some do not think he has the initiative, but he does. And by peace he meant not just peace in the world or peace of mind, but rather fulfillment, completion, and total health, so that he who begins a good work in us and through us brings it finally to full fruition. These two gifts do belong to us. I was glad when Sister Margaret Seton invited me here, although I was confronted at the same time with a certain bewilderment as to why I should be asked to be at Encounter 1971, Women Who Minister. I will, for a few moments, try to speak at this time on the new woman identity that is inner renewal, and then on the other side of that coin this evening. I do remember hearing a delightful tale that they tell in the Muslim world about a Maulvi who appeared on a Friday to speak to a congregation, and he began by saying, "Do you know what I'm going to speak about?" And they said, "No." And he said, "Then why should I speak to you?" The next Friday, he said, "Do you know what I'm going to speak to you about?" Well, they thought they wouldn't be caught again, so they said, "Yes." And he said, "Why need I speak to you?" And the next Friday, they got together and decided that they would not be caught either way, and that half of them should say yes and half no. So when he raised the question, "Oh, believers, do you know what I'm going to speak to you about?" Then half of them said yes, and half of them no. And he said, "Will those who answered yes explain to those who do not know what I'm going to speak about?" Well, I have a kind of feeling when one speaks about women and their goals and aims in these days, perhaps they say much the same that others might say. And I at least have benefited by searching my mind and searching contemporary literature to find what one could say of any significance on this very important subject. And then I won't tell you any more stories, because I do not think we live in a time when we can do that, really. We certainly cannot tell funny stories about the relationships of men and women, just as we cannot speak in our day about funny stories of an ethnic nature. Perhaps the time will come when we all shall have gained sufficient maturity that we can do this again, but it is certainly denied this generation and perhaps many generations to come. Now, if I have any credentials to speak on this subject at all, I should say that I had a mother, four sisters, a wife, and you've heard two daughters. And then I've either ordained or had responsibility in relationship to some 20 women who are preachers in New England. And you've heard about the district superintendent I appointed. And then without any shame, I say, as is true of all of us, that I am a mixture of both feminine and masculine traits, and have a certain sympathy with what I believe is going on among women in our world today, although I confess to a certain fright at some of the developments. Quincy Howe has said the 20th century has put the human race on trial for its life. So we must take this in all seriousness, for ours is an age of revolution, as we so familiarly say. It's interesting that that word revolution has not long in the English language been used in its present-day context. As recently as three centuries ago, it was still a term of astronomy. It had to do with how the heavenly spheres revolve about one another and how they made music as they did so, as the ancients would have it. Then in the English Revolution, three centuries ago, it came very much down to earth, and we have revolutions now everywhere. Among youth, among the blacks, in the third world, And we have a feminine revolution, which is the term I would rather like to reserve for that development, although I will at times speak of the women's liberation movement. I do not think they are in all respects to be identified. Perhaps I have another credential in that I have had the privilege of traveling in many parts of the world, standing at times almost in awe of the caliber of women I found, say, in Africa, or in Burma, or in Bali, where it seems to me there are outstanding representatives of womanhood. On a recent trip, very quickly, it was my privilege to visit with the woman who was the ambassador of the United States in Nepal, fully equipped to serve in that country, caught as it is between the giant on the north, China, and that other giant on the south, India. Or you could look with me for a moment at an East Pakistan family which seemed to rally about a mother who lived in one of these cement water mains we've all seen in the papers recently, living there with her children, a husband who was sick with a mattress and a blanket, in his case a newspaper, a family that had frequently to go hungry, a family which had known death of some of its members, and also I noticed that the young people, not only in this instance, the teenage young men were absent. Either they had been slaughtered or they were in guerrilla warfare somewhere on the borders between these two countries. And then to meet with the Queen of Iran on this same trip, third wife of the Shah, a very busy woman, and then to see also in another situation women from Africa as dancers with great and exuberant vitality. Now, what do these four have in common? Well, it seems to me they have this in common, whether they know it or not, and I am sure of this, that in some degree or another, all of them do know this. It is the question of what does it mean to be a human being? Or this is a worldwide question. We happen to live at a time in which there is a burst of awareness in humankind. They even have a word for this in Latin America. I don't speak Spanish, but there is a word which I'll probably mispronounce, conscientization. That is a deep awareness. We call this self-consciousness, which is, of course, the mark of a human being at all. Or we could push beyond that and speak of consciousness of consciousness. This is something that Kierkegaard speaks about. Or we could push it one degree further than that, and we could speak of the consciousness of consciousness of consciousness. That is to stand back and contemplate what it means to be aware of our awareness, to attach significance to that experience, and then to take a stance with respect to it, a faith stance, if you will, a commitment. And so our identity is realized in that commitment. A moment ago, I mentioned that I have four sisters. Now, the older sisters, as all of them, the older two, certainly had self-consciousness, as everybody does. They even, all four of them, pushed on to what I would call the consciousness of consciousness. And then the two younger sisters have pushed on to what I would call the consciousness of consciousness of consciousness, and they, both of them, wives and mothers, have, in their middle years, committed themselves in the light of that, for they saw that life put a demand upon them that they had not sensed before, that it being possible for them to significantly engage in history, they had to do so. So in mid-career, one of them became a high school teacher. They tell me she's one of the most exciting teachers in New York State today, and she's become a brand new person in the process. And the other has discovered that she's had all along a suppressed gift for the arts, and she too is finding herself and finding a way significantly to contribute in her day by the commitment which resulted from this consciousness. Now, this is evident, it seems to me, in one degree or another on every hand. We speak about ours being an age of radical upheaval, whether it is on the campus or among the young, or whether we accept, as I would for myself, the insight of Margaret Mead when she says everyone who is over 25 years of age is an alien in an alien land. Or we see this reflected in art forms. I have a 19-year-old son who listens to modern music. I do not mean rock and roll, but modern serious music, which somehow does not make sense to me, but it does to him. Or he can look at modern graphic art. I find that in my own experience, I'm only beginning to comprehend what is there. He takes this in his stride. For it seems that the artists give us a kind of preview of what is to be. And if we are not of a generation which somehow can be addressed by this, we are aliens, as Margaret Mead has said. Now, revolutions never seem to come at convenient times, perhaps because they're on God's timetable and not our own. And so we could speak at this time of being in a cultural revolution. It has its political overtones. It certainly manifests itself in scientific discoveries and technologies. It manifests itself in a style of life which is now nearly everywhere urban in its cast or influence, although we may ourselves as individuals not actually live in the metropolitan center. Just returned from India, and it is said by the year 2000, in that subcontinent, there will be four great cities, each one of them having a population of some 60 million. We're in for that sort of thing, and we're in a mood which, as we know, and it's a little painful for us as religious people to be aware of this, a prevailingly secular mood in our day. But all of these developments, which are almost universal, all surround this human question of how can we be a human being. Now, the question of identity is then raised in many forms. I believe that God sees to that. University students know that they do not live merely by knowledge, but by images by which they grasp themselves and the times in which they live. For example, young people of our day have before them a challenge which I suppose no other generation has had. What I mean is this. Up to the present generation, the previous generation has always done to a very real degree the living of our lives for us. And this was only understandable because their parents before them, with a kind of overweening concern, lived their lives for them. And it seemed that no one ever did get by that pattern to live his own life. I submit to you that this is almost literally true. And now we're at the end of that process, and not only does the present generation have to live its own life in a degree unknown to any previous generation, but they do not receive whatever comfort or consolation it may be of knowing that they can live their children's lives for them, for that too will be denied them. And this in itself would suggest that we are in a brand new ball game. Or, to take this experience of globality, which I just touched upon a moment ago by implications of the universal revolution in culture, embracing the whole globe. Teilhard de Chardin said one time that nowadays planetization proceeds apace. I think we know what he's talking about. But he raises the identity question in this guise. When we knew that we were Americans, that had a certain set of meanings. It may have been comfortable or at times uncomfortable to know we were Americans or whatever we were. But now the situation has changed, and we can't merely be Americans or anything else of a national nature anymore. Somehow we have to be people who are related to the whole globe. Now, how does one accomplish that? Or take the technological situation. Many of you will have read Toffler's book on Future Shock, in which he speaks of there Having been 800 lives lived so far, I suppose he means when mankind has been recognizably mankind, or humankind, I'd better say. But for 650 of those lives, he lived, or she lived, in caves, and it's finally only in this generation, this lifetime, that change has become the more important rubric of living than stability, which has always been the treasured stance before. Well, if that is true, how do we keep integrity? How do we keep our personhood when all around us everything is changing? Or let us take the vision of the city. This is particularly pertinent as people in Africa and in Asia move from the village where life was stable, or if one was in India, where he was captured even in this day in the caste system. He knew exactly what his role was. He knew where he was. He goes to the city, is transplanted. All the familiar supports of community living, structured community living, are removed from him, and once again, the question of identity arises. And then, in the secular kind of world we live in, this is particularly painful for those of us who are of religious vocation. How do we live with integrity and genuine selfhood in a secular age? What are its perils, or what are its possibilities? Perhaps I've already betrayed to you that it seems to me that the possibilities are very great indeed, if for no other reason, that the person of Christian vocation stands out in stark contrast to the prevailing this world and this age-mindedness which is round about him. But with women, this question of identity is raised with a particular acuteness. If one goes to Africa, for example, he discovers there that it is with men at the present time, prevailingly, that the question of identity is most acute. For he, until within this century, only a few decades ago, was a hunter or perhaps a warrior. Now the game is scarce, and intertribal warfare of the traditional kind is no longer prevalent, and so he's lost his role. Meanwhile, the African woman was and is to this day the gardener. You see her breaking her back with a short hoe in a garden patch. What I'm trying to suggest is that her identity is not so much in question, or it's just beginning to come into question. Whereas in American society, I think it would be fair to say that the question of identity is raised more sharply with the woman than with the man. Although one cannot be simplistic about this, because about the time you try to pin down a generalization of that type, then we find that the other partner has the question of identity raised in his or her case, and exactly that is happening. I would, however, like to suggest that there's a kind of grace of God here, that perhaps in a given culture, the question of identity is not raised with the same intensity at the same time for both men and women, so that there is just the possibility that there can be some mutual support in this process. But sooner or later, when the question of identity is raised in one person's experience, in this case women's or men's, sooner or later then the opposite will be true. Well, and this question is raised because women especially have long been stereotyped in our culture. I might say stereotyped usually by men. The slick magazines, many of them having men as editors, have placed before American women rather narrow options. These are now hopefully being called into question by young women, and I find my daughters could not care less about what a slick woman's magazine say that a woman should look like or the way she should dress. Or women have had traditionally assigned roles. They've been told their places in the home, very much as used to be common in some parts of our country. I like a Negro, but I like him in his place. It's really the same sort of lingo that says that. And the perpetuated, now outworn, images of Kindern, Kuchen, and Kirche, They have placed women on pedestals, and the women themselves knew they were not there. Or they have demeaned them, as one article suggests lately with these categories, that women are either secretaries or sex pots or spenders or sows or civic action people. Leave PA to them. Or they are sickies. Or there is this easy assumption that the only appropriate norm is to marry, and those who do not marry are regarded as second-class peoples. Or some of the traditional roles which women perhaps legitimately had, that is, caring for the sick and for children and caring for the dead and visiting the aged, these things also are deprived and have been taken over largely and formally by men in our society. My eldest daughter was with her mother in Lucknow in 1968 for a brief visit in a home. The girl went there in the morning, was met by the man of the house, and his wife was assigned to a guest room, and saw something of the city of Lucknow that day. Then a tragic thing happened during the day. The man of the house died. He was brought home, not to some undertaking establishment, because there wasn't any, and my daughter was asked to give up her bedroom and her bed, and his lifeless body was laid out there. And her mother and herself slept that night, to the degree that they did sleep, in an adjoining room. And then the next morning, my daughter tells of how she was awakened to the sound of pounding, much pounding, in the backyard. Her mother, who was born in India, was able readily to identify that sound. They were building a coffin for the man of the house. And, well, the point is, to her great-grandmother, all of this would have been rather familiar. And it was a marvelous, even a revelatory experience in her life, which so sobered her that in another context in India, her life's vocation opened up to her. But this could no longer be taken for granted, because women do not care for the dead, the laying out of the dead. Men usually, undertakers do that. And they do not care for the delivering of children, for midwifery has now been scientized, and men called obstetricians, and a little later on pediatricians, mainly men, take care of that. And as someone put it, so far as visiting the aged and infirm, that's more likely to be an insurance agent, or perhaps a minister who is more likely also to be a man. Well, maybe I have enlarged more than you desire for me to do on this, but when the question of identity is raised, then it is that women discover their bondage, that they have been in a cage, and not of their own devising, and all too often it has not even been a gilded cage. They've been locked in. And this is a kind of worldwide situation. One could illustrate it in, of course, a whole raft of ways. But perhaps a very striking one I might hazard. I recently visited a tomb of a Muslim king in Bidar in central India. Well, it was a rather massive tomb, a little after the model on the lesser degree of the Taj Mahal. And alongside it, I counted 64 small tombs, not quite so impressive. And upon investigation, I discovered that they were his 64 wives. And this king of about three centuries ago, when he was aged and infirm and not long for this world, wondered what would be the fate of these wives. And so he took the situation into his own hand. This is a story which can be documented. Took it into his own hand, invited all the wives to a magnificent banquet, gave them jewels, gave them drink, and saw that it was liberally poisoned. He took care of them all and then followed them into the next world. Well, that may be a little extreme. But it is at least a token of what manipulation can, in the final analysis, mean. To be cut out, to be fenced in, to be trivialized, as women are rather disgustingly on television today. I've never, I think, met a real live woman who had an excessive enthusiasm about soap or about how white her husband's shirts or her brother's shirts might be. But we are given to suppose that this is a great passion on the part of women in our society, and on the other hand, make them sex symbols, inviting their exploitation, or again, trivialize them by calling them playmates and toys and bunnies, if there had only been the imagination to call them tigresses, if we must get into that. And so male chauvinism is something which is very real, and the very fact that it is often unconscious means that it is therefore perhaps the more disturbing, and also it is worldwide, as someone has called it, the most persistent form of imperialism. And even in the church, women, as a rule, have their assigned roles, limited very frequently. They are supposed, for the most part, to be theologically illiterate. And in the final analysis, they are there, dominated. And as we have been so often reminded, even in recent days, the Holy Spirit, we call He, and there are those up to this moment who would stoutly entrench themselves to defend this point of view. So that the divine image, as well as the ideal human image, is male in its nature. And if one would suppose that he could escape from this by going to some other religious fold, the situation, I want to say to you, is even worse in Islam, which is really a militant male brotherhood, and in some respects, worse still within Hinduism. And I do not wish to reflect on others when I remind us of that Jewish prayer in which men thank God they were not born women. I hope by this time it is clear that in my judgment you should thank God that you are, for there is a great task to perform in our day, and it is precisely this, that half of the human race, which has been long inhibited, should not be longer inhibited. Because of this, all humankind suffers. Now, alas, some have not been awakened in this respect. They are still confined sometimes when even the bars are down. They're like a confined lioness who walks within the former borders of confinement, seemingly rejoicing in it. But where this is seen, there is afforded a new vision of possibility, of great psychological and sociological and spiritual significance. For all mankind, I think, all humankind searches for freedom and significance and possibility, and this is the vision which is now laid out before us. Meanwhile, there must be a battle for equality, which will now proceed in earnest. In a token sort of way, it's been going on for two centuries. In the political realm, such figures as Susan B. Anthony brought the vote to women in this country a little belatedly, because it came first in Australia and Britain and Scandinavia before it finally came here, and I believe our Swiss sisters don't have it even yet. Oh, wonderful. They got it. Well, that makes it almost unanimous, I guess, doesn't it? But I remember yet, and this dates me, when the vote came to women, and my father would always attempt to worm the information out of my mother, always unsuccessfully, as to whom she had voted for, but she let him know that she had voted by secret ballot, and it ended there. Or there was a kind of liberation in a sociological sense, even by the flappers of the 20s. And I suppose that women ought to pay, I suppose in many instances, a rather reluctant debt in that direction. Or economically, the liberation was moved forward during World War II with Rosie the Riveter, who was used and even oft-times exploited and then sent back to the suburbs when her labor was regarded as surplus. And so I think we could, most of us, reckoned with the fact that after World War II, there was a kind of swing back to Snug Harbor. There was a... Again, marriage was regarded as the only appropriate goal for a young woman. And perhaps a prevailing image became that of Grace Kelly, who was a kind of an ideal of the fact that every woman was, after all, princess in her home. But if she liked to live in that world of illusion, it was not available to her very long, for then came the bomb, and that other bomb, the pill, and then came Sputnik. These were signals for all who even run to read that old patterns were gone and new possibilities had opened up, for good or for ill. I think it would be fair to say that we've always had trouble with heroines. Hero images also have largely been male, and I've tested this out sometime in conversations with women's groups. And when you press them, who are your heroines? Well, perhaps they don't have any, or they're very slow in coming up with them. Well, we could all name some, whether it was Madame Curie, or Amelia Earhart, or Eleanor Roosevelt, all of whom are images of the fact that the old understanding of what it is to be female has now been cracked. And some of these heroines are perhaps nameless, as that woman in Montgomery said, "My feet is tired, but my heart is light." Or briefly, and I emphasize briefly, Jacqueline Kennedy, who rose to a height of which every person, man and woman in this country, could be proud, and then perhaps frittered away that capital. I'm not speaking now of her marriage, and because that is for her to decide, but I'm speaking of the style of life which she elected to take after she had been a part of an image which ought to have been an inspiration to us all. Or we find other images in Indira Gandhi, or Golda Meir, or Coretta King, or Joan Baez, who could not only sing of a new day, but adopt the style of life which her very song and the very sound seemed to require. Well, the struggle was necessarily with the male, or with the male image. I think there's a deep wisdom in Eastern Asia where they speak of yang and yin, of dark and light. Now, no value must necessarily be attached to either one of these terms, but they have to do with the male and the female principle. It goes on within us all. It is expressed in classic myths such as Adam and Eve. It is present, perhaps I have no real data on which to generalize, but I should judge it is present in every marriage. And it is found in the inequality which creates tension within every social order I know anything about. And the struggle continues on the ontological level and on the missional level and on the personal level. And by the ontological level, I mean simply this, the question of what does it mean to be a woman, which is a woman's way of asking the classic human question of our time, what does it mean to be a human being? I learned the other day of a missionary wife who commented that for 31 years she had served as an asterisk in China. She meant, of course, that she was placed as an asterisk after her husband's name, and in some footnote somewhere it said that he had a wife, and she was it. Now, this question is not only a matter of knowing, it's not a mere intellectualizing, but it's a kind of musculature question, if you will, for in our day, our being and our knowing and our doing are all wrapped up in one. And it has concretized this question in a missional sense. How shall I invest my life in relationship to the world's real problems? And it becomes a personal grasp, a grappling too. Having raised that question, where is an answer to be found? Is it found in going again into the past, returning, if you will, to the cage? Is it found by identifying ourselves with some ideal model? Is it found simply by going back to school and getting a master's degree so that, as someone put it, one becomes a polished showpiece? Or is it to dabble in all kinds of things? Or is it to engage in do-goodism somewhere? Or rather, does it involve this of a decision to be a significant person? Now, the struggle begins with women's rights, but it certainly does not end there, for the securing of the vote was only a starting point, although I must comment that I do not think there's ever any evidence of women having used quite the power of the ballot which is open to them, and it seems that young people are going to follow in that same train for a while at any rate. But as long as in our society women receive $60 for every $100 that a man would receive for the same work, it is necessary that there be struggle. And as long as a college graduate who is a woman receives the same level of employment and compensation on an average of a man with an eighth grade education, it is necessary to struggle. It is no wonder then. It is rather a matter of great satisfaction that we hear of such things as Women's March for Equality and National Women's Political Caucus and that kind of thing. Because if seriously pursued, this struggle issues finally into a global struggle of worldwide, yes, and of history-long importance. It takes in the whole world because it is the whole human struggle. So long as one group must manipulate another, whether for the possession of things or the possession of people, then all are denied the humanity. And this, in the final analysis, is an all-out struggle for humanity. Now, the price of this struggle is the commitment of lives. Women themselves, of course, must take the lead. There's never any really voluntary and enthusiastic surrender of power. Those who are in power don't generally start revolutions. Oh, there may be a slight exception in the case of John 23rd. He seems to be a little exception here, for he used his power to start a revolution, and we have not seen the end of it. But I've suggested a strange human alliance, intended or unintended, among all the revolutions of our time. And then, if women take the lead, they may just discover that they have many allies in what appears to be the enemy's camp. It was interesting that this past summer on Broadway, three, I believe, simultaneously of Ibsen's plays were given there. And what an understanding friend of womanhood we have in Ibsen. And now to win, women have had to stress and overstress the male principle. If you're going to combat with masculinity, you have to use some of his weapons, including perhaps the weapon that he is most sensitive to of all, if I may reveal this to you, ridicule. He's very, very sensitive at this point. Masculinity is exceedingly proud, and I think with respect to the use of such weaponry, it has not been unheard of that he has used this with respect to women for a long, long time. How effectively, you must report. Or it may be necessary to do a little dividing of ranks of the enemy if one would conquer. There has been along the way an imitation of man, I suppose, this necessary, a kind of reversal of role. In the extreme, there have been those, of course, as we're all familiar, who have said there's no distinction, no distinction biologically even. It's only the difference due to cultural accretion. And then some can even quote a little scripture which would seem to indicate that way. Well, the chance that that scripture's already been quoted here, I will not repeat it. But for my part, it would seem to me that that's a rather hazardous course to take. For finally, it will be a losing battle, in my judgment. For integrity, once again, is violated. Nevertheless, some of the masculine weapons have had to be used if it is to register upon masculinity and the bondage which it has imposed upon femininity throughout the whole world. But now, I suggest that it is possible to be feminine again without losing all that ground. But this, along the way, has created interior tension for all. I suggested already that woman's search for identity has brought uncertainty to the male's role. It's been an economic threat to him. It's making man, too, aware of his chains. For as long as he was not made to strain against them, he scarcely realized that they were there. Now, this along the way, too, has excited fear among allies or potential allies, so that very frequently we are told black women have distrusted the feminine revolution, that it's a family quarrel in reality among the whites. Well, I hope that that point of view will not prevail, because something is more at stake here. And I repeat again that it is the future of all humanity itself. And of course, when femininity engages in the struggle, along the way it invites a certain reaction, sometimes vicious reaction. Maybe you heard, as I did earlier this week, on a television program. I didn't even know there were right-wing pop singers, but one of them was introduced, and he sang. Didn't seem to me it was a very good song. Get them young, treat them rough, and tell them nothing. And then, of course, he only revealed that he was moving rather deliberately back into the dark ages. This did not reflect on womanhood, but upon manhood, at least as he was representing it. And it is issued in certain social perversions. That is to say, the fact that a revolution is going on might just be a temptation for someone to corrupt it for some personal therapy. It's something more than that. And it is open also, the feminine revolution I'm talking about, to all the perversions and self-righteousness that any other human enterprise might encounter. And it is healthy precisely to the degree that it can be self-critical and be poised in the presence of criticism from the outside. For there is the danger of it becoming merely a movement, a partisan movement, captured by some partisans within it, or a mere churning up of the waters and a final loss of thrust, or a false assumption here, driving at goals which have been men's goals but already repudiated by the more sensitive among them. I mean the fact that a name on a door or a name inscribed on a desk with a certain office behind it might be more important than the trivia with which women are supposed traditionally to have to do. Now, this has not been exhaustive as a critique, but I've hinted at some of the perils along the way. Nevertheless, it has formed the beginning, this struggle of what it means to be a woman, what authentic femininity really is. Now, we certainly don't know, and I, as a male, certainly don't know the answers here. I do think we all must have a certain modesty. We must keep open. For when authentic femininity stands forth, then authentic humanity stands there. So the road will not be unambiguous. It will require a certain experimentation and exploration, but finally, even now, in a tentative way, calls for new styles, new signs, and new symbols. For whether the world likes it or not, personally I like it, a new woman is emerging. The search for identity is bearing fruit. I like that passage, and I wish I could quote it offhand verbatim, but it's in Doll's House when Nora's husband said, First of all, you must be a wife and mother. How many times that refrain has been sung in human history? But Nora, and this was 90 years ago when he wrote that play, Nora answered, no, it's not. First of all, I must be a human being, the same as you, or at least attempt to be one. Well, he spoke and she spoke a good deal before her time. She was kind of a forerunner of a new spiritual reality, which is abroad in the world. And when this happens, it's a great event, a new creation. For the whole creation, to use Paul's language, waits with eager expectation, with noses pressed against the window, for the real revealing of the children of God. For if half of humankind has been in a kind of thraldom, what an event it is when finally freedom arrives on the horizon. And since we're speaking not just of the freedom of women, but of femininity, in which I share a portion, just as you share masculinity, then it seems to me to a very real degree, I too, in that very fact, am set free. This can only happen when women determine to be themselves, not bound to the past on the one hand, or attached tenaciously to some assigned role on the other, nor in imitation of maleness, but in authentic personhood. This will surely awaken and release authenticity in others, not in fragmentation, but a commitment of the whole self to the whole task. This is something of what we mean, not just of consciousness, or even by consciousness of consciousness, but of consciousness of consciousness of consciousness, when we stand back from ourselves and realize we're conscious of being conscious, then a demand is put upon us, which is only satisfied by total commitment. And then do we not see that this is in reality new creation, for it fulfills the will of the Creator, who presumably knew what he was doing in the first place. Just think of how the shackles go away when we no longer have to fill an assigned role, I repeat, assigned too often by men, but we decide to be God's person. And there's a certain invincible quality about this decision once it's made. To say yes to our creaturehood, whether man or woman, is a saying yes to our Creator. Not to save ourselves or even save up ourselves, as has so often been advocated as an appropriate role for women, but giving ourselves for the things that really matter. It's a saying yes to the mystery of being. I wouldn't call that mystery if I knew exactly what I meant by it. But if I may be personal, my wife and I have been married now for 31 years. We've discovered a kind of comradeship along the way, a maturity that I did not know was possible. No one ever tipped me off on that. And even on that base, however, I can look, as it were, into her eyes, to be poetic for a moment, and I see depths there as yet almost entirely unfathomed. Mystery, even among those well known to us, think of that greater mystery when we look by chance deeply into the eyes of a child in need, oh, say of that family dwelling in a water pipe as refugees from East Pakistan. Just fathomless depth there. But just supposing all the promise and all the possibility known only to the author of being would have a chance to blossom. Now that's what I'm really talking about. And if I haven't made that clear, it's just because this subject is too difficult for me. A new initiative is possible for femininity because, after all, woman produces mankind. This is her unique glory. No one else can claim that. And so it is possible for her to take the stance of seeing to it that all humankind comes off according to the intent of the Creator, or at least being engaged in that tremendous enterprise, devoted to its full fruition. Meanwhile, there's appearing a new relationship between masculinity and femininity. Or I've suggested that this, a yes to ourselves is a yes to all humanity. And when man is in the presence of authentic womanhood, authentic manhood becomes possible for him too. There's a great artist in Bali, he happens to be a Dutchman. I asked him, what it is that you try to bring out when you paint a picture, say of a person, or do a sculpture? He said, I try to release the giant within that person. Or maybe you think that's excessively homiletical, I do not know. But isn't that a tremendous assigned role? And so there's a future, not for man or woman, as if those were options really open to any of us. That is, that we can elect to be either way, but for man and woman. For the one flesh is the image of God, and this not only realized in marriage, but in a different respect. One flesh, reflection of the image of God in collective achievement of all humankind. We'd be getting something where close to the meaning of the incarnation, I think, there. Which has been called the primal relationship and the very center of humanity. And then a kind of transmutation of sex and marriage and family, and I want to get into that a little more tonight. I have been pleased, however, to hear women here and there who have taken jobs not just to increase the income in the home as such, or even release satisfaction, but so their husbands could take less remunerative jobs but jobs with greater social significance. Now, there's some message there for us, I think. Or for the family to extend until it embraces all mankind, and we're all part of that sort of family. Well, at any rate, it looks toward an inclusive new role for women in the meaning and determination of history, whose goal is to humanize all humanity. I am persuaded that women have many rich gifts to bring. More to of that later. Now, perhaps I've only hinted at identity. But I think women who minister by their very vocation ought to have a certain instinct here, which even with my feeble words has enabled you to read between the lines as to what is intended. Well, my one last word of testimony is that the female or the feminine revolution is, in fact, evidence of the stirring of the Holy Spirit in the world. It's present also in the black revolution, stirring also in the third world and among the young, and the outcome will not be confined to the limits and boundaries of society as we've known it. And there is, in fact, no turning back once we've launched on this path. For once we've tasted of the fruit of the tree of knowledge, Eden is forever closed to us. We can't go back to some utopia of the past. And the fact of the matter is, our entrance is inhibited by an angel with a flaming sword.